Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, many individuals treated for HIV infection are now living a near normal life expectancy, which is truly an amazing change since this disease was first came to recognition in the 1980s in such a big way. Who becomes infected, when they are infected, and how they are infected has changed quite a bit as well. What we all need to know today about HIV and AIDS is our topic. To help us kind of learn all this information, our guests are Heather Davis. Heather is making her third or fourth appearance on this program. She's the executive director of the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association. And with her in the studio is James Terry. He's director of development for the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association. And kindly joining us from out of town by telephone is Terry Bramall. Terry has been on the program a couple of times. She's the HIV clinical specialist, so she's our medical resource, and she works with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Welcome to all of you to Line One. Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for having
us.
What do we do to start here? What's the epidemiology of AIDS in Alaska? You know, we hear so much about it. What do we need to know? Who's getting it? When are they getting it? How soon do they know they've got it once they do it? How do they find out if they've been infected?
I'll jump in on that. This is James. One thing that we know is that the number of new HIV infections in Alaska has been rising for the last year or so. We saw 42 new infections last year, with only about 24 the year before that. And many of those new infections continue to be in men who have sex with men. We also saw quite a few in the last year in the homeless community in Anchorage. So that's sort of another pocket of new infections that we're seeing. There are still some infections being spread through injection drug use, although that's a much smaller amount than those spread through sexual contact. And HIV continues to affect people of all different ages and ethnicities and races. It's sort of across the board, but with concentrations in certain communities.
One of the big changes, obviously, is the medical interventions that have caused some AIDS. In fact, may have been the origin of AIDS breaking out of Africa years ago. But that's not an issue anymore. I think people still may be worried about blood transfusions and getting blood drawn and so forth, but I don't hear so much about that. That's not an issue hardly anymore.
No.
Okay. And what is the, once a person has been exposed and becomes infected, what's the length of time before they may have symptoms?
Well, that's changed a lot as well. Oh, sorry, Terry. This is Heather. People can live with HIV for 10 years or more and not have any symptoms at all. And so that's one of the reasons HIV testing is so critical, because you can be living with this disease and not realize you have it.
And even though there are no symptoms, this is Terry, there is still damage being done in the body. It just takes 10 years or so before that damage becomes evident.
I want to come back to the damage issue so we understand what's happening, but in that roughly 10 years from the period of time you've caught the infection before you know you're symptomatic, and another reason for to help what Heather said about the importance of getting testing is that you're infectious during that period of time. Is that true? So there's that 10-year period a person who may be infected does not know it and yet can be readily transmitting that particular infection to others.
Absolutely, and that's why it's so important to get tested. Uh-huh. Because that's a long time period, and depending on your sexual habits, you could be infecting mm-hmm. a great number of people.
And it's primarily now a sexually transmitted disease, is what I've heard you guys both imply and say.
Yeah, it is primarily sexually transmitted, with still a significant number of new infections coming through sharing needles as well. But that's mm-hmm. a much smaller amount than mm-hmm. than through sexual activity.
Nationally, it's about 15% through IV drug use, but that really varies depending on the region of the country.
And that brings up this issue that Terry, you brought up before we came on the air, as that's that recent outbreak in Indiana. Would you mind just since it's about 15% of new cases seems to be needle stick exposure, could you describe what we know about the Indiana outbreak and what has been successful, it appears, to finally quelling that outbreak?
Well, what we know about it was there was a high incidence of sharing needles, people using, I believe it was oxymorphone, and they had this huge outbreak that they had not seen in the past and traced it back to people sharing needles. And because of the federal ban and state bans on syringe exchange for clean syringes and works, it was difficult to address. However, the public health convinced the authorities in the state that this was the only way to effectively combat this epidemic, and they were able to fairly rapidly get a syringe exchange into place in the areas where this outbreak was, and were able to slow down this outbreak to baseline levels. So they're not getting a lot of new infections now.
So there's been some arguments against the needle sharing idea. What's the arguments on that side?
Providing clean needles to injection drug users is that we're implicitly supporting their use of IV drugs. Uh-huh. And this goes against what all public health officials and programs are saying, that this is really an important tool in combating stopping the spread of disease. And it actually has a positive effect. Maybe Heather could address this, in that it does put IV drug users in contact with the healthcare system or other systems that may actually help them get out of their drug using habits.
I've gotten somewhat interested in how people go about making decisions, and not just healthcare decisions, but all kinds of decisions, as we are constantly struggling to get more and more people immunized, which seems to be one of our greatest public health benefits, and yet there's still a lot of holdouts. And it turns out, as we study how people make decisions, we often use feelings and emotions rather than facts. And this seems like another one of those situations where maybe intuitively it seems like we may be promoting the use of IV drugs by providing clean needles, but the reality is, the testing, the evidence is, that's not true, and in fact, it has been very helpful. Am I misstating or overstating that issue?
I think that you're right on the mark there, that there have been lots of studies that give us scientific data about how syringe access programs work, and we know that they not only reduce HIV infections and hepatitis C infections, they also actually lower the rates of drug use, that people are likely to use less in quantity and less over time if they are accessing these programs where they have access to other resources and care and referrals into treatment when they're ready for that. Mm-hmm. And so we know all of that. Sort of the data shows that these work, but there is still sort of an emotional gut reaction that some people have to, if somebody's using drugs, I don't want to support that.
Yeah, it sounds like it should be right, but the evidence is against it, and then we go back to our emotions and deny the facts, and that happens a lot. It seems to be a very big reason for the vaccination resistors to a large degree.
And this is Terry, and I do want to point out that this is relevant in Alaska. We don't hear necessarily a lot about it in the news, but I hear about it from rural providers. I've made some trips to rural areas and sense some desperation in the medical community there, because we have no syringe exchange, any access to syringe exchange in the rural areas, and they are seeing a burgeoning epidemic of IV drug use, primarily heroin, in the rural hubs and at the village level. So there's a huge concern about this, and we, could be the next Indiana. We have not had an issue yet, but it only takes, it's like Russian roulette. It just takes one loaded barrel, and it spreads like wildfire.
Well, let me follow up along that line and ask. James was saying that we've had an increase in new diagnoses of HIV infections over previous years? And is there any epidemiology, any research looking into why that is? And I guess I'm asking specifically, could it be related to more IV drug use and the laws around that? Do we know that?
Most of the new infections that we're seeing in Alaska right now are not in injection drug users.
Okay.
So it's not a higher number of that particular type of new infection so far.
Okay.
And what we actually see in the injection drug using population, this is Heather, is a greater incidence of hepatitis C. We're at the 4-H's, we can do a rapid hepatitis C testing as well, and that's a much bigger concern with that population.
So hepatitis C would be a little bit more evidence that this is an IV drug use source of HIV infection, if they're both positive.
Potentially.
And
hepatitis C is also just much more prevalent in Alaska right now, so people are more likely to have been exposed to it but via sharing needles. And we know that in Indiana, there was a hepatitis C outbreak that preceded the HIV outbreak. It was sort of the canary in the coal mine that was not paid attention to there.
Right.
We don't want the same thing to happen here.
Right. You know, I failed to give out our phone number. For those of you listening today, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. This is originating from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. Our contact numbers, if you would like to give us a call, we'll be here for about 50 minutes or so. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We also can provide a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and email address, line1, and you have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. So if you have questions or comments about HIV infections, the illness that is a consequence of that infection, we call acquired immunodeficiency syndrome or disease, AIDS, please give us a call or send us an email. Another question coming to my mind is when we're saying that there's 10 years of average length of time between infection and symptoms that might bring someone to recognize they're sick and therefore perhaps getting tested. How many undiagnosed individuals are out there in the United States? And if we know it for Alaska, can we do the math on that? Is there a way to get an estimate?
Well, the CDC estimate is that there are about 1.2 million people living with HIV in the United States, and that of those, about 1 in 5 don't know that they're HIV positive.
Okay.
So in Alaska, there are closer to 600 or 700 people known to be living with HIV. So we can extrapolate that there's, you know,
about
another
20% of those.
20% of those who may not know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Terry, if you don't mind, let me ask you, what's happening once the HIV infection occurs? What's happening as far as the infection? What's the organism doing? And what happens to lead to symptoms?
Well, what happens when it infects a human is that it is integrated into the human cells, the white blood cells, the CD4 cells, which are kind of the boss of the immune system. So they direct the other white blood cells to attack infection, and HIV turns those cells into a factory to make more HIV and eventually wipes them out. So first we get sort of a disorganization of the immune system and then a depletion of the immune system. And eventually, because we have a depletion of the immune system, people, once they become advanced in the AIDS stage, can't fight off infections that normally we can fight off. In the meantime, the other thing that's going on is that the immune system is activated and we have inflammation going on, which can lead to long-term sort of chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease. So there's kind of two processes going on.
So
we used to only focus on the immune deficiency because
right.
that's all we understood. And once we were able to actually control that with the new medications that work really well, then we were able to see that there was also this inflammatory response going on that was leading to increases in other diseases that were not infectious.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, what's happened fairly recently in medicine is to recognize that the immune response causing inflammation can peripherally cause its own kinds of problems and lead to disability and perhaps earlier death than would be predicted, is what I'm hearing you say.
Yes.
What about diagnosis? You know, the problem is getting people diagnosed, and I understand there's now you can go down and buy a test. So why are we having still trouble with people getting diagnosed and tested?
This is James. I think there are lots of possible answers to that. And one, a big one, I think, is that people may just not recognize that they are at risk. People's self-perception of risk is often very different than the reality of risk. And the CDC recommends that anybody between the ages of 13 and 64 be tested for HIV. So it's really all of us should be testing as part of routine healthcare. Certainly anybody who has ever had sex has potential risk. And I think people sometimes get caught in, well, I've only had sex with people that I know or that I trust, and so I couldn't be at risk. And we know that that's not really the way that it works. So part of it is people's self-perception of risk. Part of it may also be fear, that people simply don't want to know. People who do have a high perception of risk and know they may have been exposed would rather just not know what they expect to be bad news. So I think both of those things play into what prevents people from testing.
And we also find 9 years after CDC came out with these recommendations, and then A couple of years ago, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force backed them up as well with a grade A recommendation for testing, is that providers still are reluctant to suggest HIV testing in many cases, even when risk is apparent. And, you know, we still can't quite understand why it's so difficult to just get people tested. Mm-hmm. It's a simple test. It's a life-saving test. It's a quality of life-improving test.
How about cost and availability? Is that an issue?
It's an inexpensive test. There's free testing available in many places. Heather can address that. It's covered with the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendation. It's covered under Medicaid, Medicare, and preventive services under Affordable Care Act. It's now preventive service, so it's covered under insurance.
How about what's the cost of the test that's available in the pharmacies and the accuracy of that testing?
The test in the pharmacy is somewhere between $40 and $50, and it is accurate. There's a period of time, about a month to 6 weeks, before it will actually pick up infection after someone's been infected. But it is also a screening test, so if it is positive, it needs to be followed with a confirmatory test.
Terry,
which would need to be a blood draw.
Yeah. Terry, could you explain to listeners again? I think maybe it'll stick with them better if they understand why there's that period of time between possible exposure and possibility that tests are going to be positive. Why is that?
Well, there's the test that we've used for many years is an antibody test. So when we screen for HIV, we're screening for the antibody to the virus. And it takes our body a period of time before we generate enough antibody that the test turns positive. And over the years, those tests have gotten more and more sensitive. So in the early days, it could have taken as long as 6 months for that test to turn positive after someone got infected. Now with the newer tests, it's more like 4 to 6 weeks before most tests had turned positive. And with the very newest test, which actually combines the antibody with a viral test called an antigen test, which is a particle of the virus, we could pick up infection as early as 2 weeks after somebody's been infected, but that is not with the home test or the rapid test that we're using. Mm-hmm. That would be, you know, through a medical lab.
Right. So, and again, what's happening is that virus is integrating itself into cells, and it does take time for it to regenerate a number of copies of itself that can be detected. So it's... I think a misconception is if you had some unprotected sex, you were worried that very quickly you could be tested, and that's not the right answer.
Correct.
What I think I would add to that, though, is that, well, certainly you cannot have an accurate test immediately after a risky encounter. If you know that you were exposed to HIV, you can seek what's called PEP, or post-exposure prophylaxis. And somebody who has definitely been exposed, either via sex or via blood, or you know, whether it's medical or needle sharing, you have a known exposure and can seek a pill, basically, that you take for a period beginning within 72 hours after that exposure. It can prevent the HIV from actually infecting that person.
Very important comment, and that's new information. I have somebody waiting for a call. I want to take that, and then let's come back to that,
sure,
that issue. That's some new information that I think has come out, particularly since the last time we've talked about this. Roger, you're on line one. What can we talk about? What can we answer for you?
Well, my name is Roger Hudson. I just wanted to maybe bootstrap on the last comment because over the last several years, medically, there's been some good testing done that really confirms that from the broad public health standpoint that treatment is prevention in terms of transmission. The earlier people who are diagnosed as having HIV before that long dormant period when their own system goes down, they are potentially infectious. But if they can get on the drug regimen, the antiretrovirals, early, their probability of passing on the virus to other people is greatly suppressed, so that the long-term solution to this whole issue is, you know, to get people diagnosed, to get them early treatment. And I think probably in the United States that's being done, but around the world there are huge cost challenges. The U.S. has been the global leader in trying to get people, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, on the antiretrovirals through both the President's Emergency Program called PEPFAR and through our U.S. contributions to the Global Fund to Fight HTB and Malaria. But I want your listeners to be aware that there's great concern in the global health community about the provisions of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which boost up the pharmaceutical companies' intellectual property rights and are putting at risk the availability of, generic developing country manufactured ARVs, that's a big concern. And I wondered if any of your guests had any comment or involvement with the international situation or what they might have to say about the affordability of the drugs here in the United States.
Thanks, Roger. Oh. This is Heather talking. We don't really do the international work per se. We're really focused on Alaska. But absolutely, what you say about getting people diagnosed as soon as possible to get them on treatment and treatment as prevention is absolutely true. We know that. As to the cost of medications, here in the United States, they aren't cheap. We're lucky, and now that people don't have to take big handfuls of pills like they used to, they can often be on even a one pill a day regimen. However, the average cost for medications for somebody getting treatment can be anywhere from $14,000 to $40,000 a year for a drug. This can be covered by private health insurance, Medicaid, Medicare. Sometimes there are state and community programs, and then, of course, there's the National AIDS Drug Assistance Program, which Alaska also has here in the state, and which the Forays oversees for the state.
This is Terry, and I can comment on the international situation, and I can't comment on pharma because I'd go on for hours, but internationally, we have seen in the last 13 years through PEPFAR and AMFAR, there has been a big rollout of antiretrovirals in sub-Saharan Africa and other countries, and we also have seen a decrease in new infections over that period of time by about 30%. So it is making a difference, but still only about 30% or less of the people that need antiretrovirals are getting them in those countries. But they do have much more affordable medications available than we do here in the U.S. Interestingly, in the U.S., we have not seen a big drop-off in new infections despite, you know, good medical care and availability of good medications.
Well, thanks. If I'm still live, I don't know if I am, but the dramatic increase, like there's something like 10 million people who are now on the drugs and are alive because of that, vast majority of whom would have passed away by now at huge cost to their families and the society in general. But the cost of the drugs, a lot of them coming from India or Brazil, that are, you know, basically not being paid, any big money being paid to the big pharmaceutical companies that are being manufactured generically, has allowed something like, I said, 10 million people to be on those drugs, and when the problem started being addressed a little more than a decade ago, there were only like 50,000 people, very tiny percentage of affected people that could afford the treatment, and the progress that's been made in that is tremendous. I certainly agree with you that there's, you know, because we now know that the ARV treatment should begin as soon as somebody has been, identified as having HIV, because of the vast number of infections and the still limited resources in developing countries, the highest priority has been to get people on drugs who are already experiencing, suppression of their immune system and opportunistic infections, especially TB. But the need is for, our Congress makes the decisions about how to spend money to be aware of the importance of maintaining support for these things, because, there still is a cross-border factor in terms of these infectious diseases have to be addressed globally. But I thank you guys for, your comment and for coming on that show, and it's very informative, very appreciated what you do.
Yeah, Roger, thanks for your comments, especially about the international situation. You have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right. Let me remind everyone once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number, 550-8433. 550-8433. Toll free, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and we'll continue our discussion on what we all need to know today about HIV and AIDS. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSK or for KSK and Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, our guests are Heather Davis. She is in the studio with James Terry. Heather is the executive director of the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association, and James Terry is director of development. Also joining us by telephone is Terry Bramble. Terry is an HIV clinical specialist with the Alaska Native Health Consortium. What we're trying to do is bring everybody up to date on what's really the changing epidemiology and the new treatment options that are available and the importance of finding individuals who are infected and who may not know they're infected. There's a 10-year window on average between infection and symptoms. And if we can identify those individuals and help them keep their load of this virus down, which we're going to talk about here in just a little bit again, then we can really dramatically decrease the problem of HIV infection and AIDS. Unfortunately, we've learned to date that our numbers are up this year, so we still need to keep educating everyone about what they can do about helping those numbers. Our email address for questions over the next 30 minutes or so, line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local telephone number, 550-8433, 550-8433, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. I always like to remind people that you can't hear us or can't ask questions if you're listening to the program between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday evenings, because that's a taped rebroadcast, so this is the time to be doing that. However, if you do hear the taped broadcast or you would like to listen to it later, you can go to alaskapublic.org, find the Line 1 link, and at that link you can find our archives and listen to the program or refer somebody that you think would be interested or it'd be really important to hear the program at any time. So, James, let's come back to this issue you brought up and described as post-exposure prophylaxis. So what we've learned today is that after infection, after doing some behavior, often sex or needle stick exposure, you acquire this virus. It will take a while to begin to reproduce itself, and then that reproduction slowly over a period of 10 years is causing some significant problems that leads to this disease we call AIDS, which used to be pretty much a death sentence, but now is being controlled much more appropriately. But we're in this situation where we'd like to stop the transmission as soon as we can, and during that period of time when people are uninfected, or don't know they're infected, I should say. And so that's one of the big reasons for pushing getting tested, because if we know you're infected, then we can do something. And now we know we can do something during that period of time.
Yeah, so going back to PEP a little bit, the idea of PEP is it's meant to be something that somebody wouldn't use more than once or twice in their life. It's for really exceptional circumstances. And it originated, I think, with use within the medical field. If nurses were caring for somebody with HIV and had an accidental needle stick, they were the first ones to have access to PEP. And it can be available to anybody who needs it if they have a known risk, and it's quite expensive. So it's not, again, something that we would want to use all of the time. But say that you have a sexual encounter with somebody and you learn afterwards that they were HIV positive, or that you used a condom knowing that, but the condom broke. Something exceptional happened, and you find out immediately. If you can begin PEP within 72 hours, it prevents infection despite exposure. And that's separate from the tool called PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis. And that's something that people can be on a prescription basis in an ongoing way to prevent exposure if they're in high-risk situations, or prevent infection if they are being exposed.
Terry, any comments on that we haven't discussed or anything we need to feather out a little bit better about the post-exposure prophylaxis?
No, James explained it pretty well, but it is available locally in Anchorage and probably in other areas, usually through the emergency room if it's if there's been a sexual exposure, a sexual assault, it's supposed to be readily available. And usually they'll give 3 days' worth of medications and then have the person follow up with either an infectious disease doc or somebody else to really assess how big the risk is and whether to continue the full 28 days of treatment. It's not 100% in preventing infection, but it's pretty significant reduction in infection rates if you get on it. The sooner the better, within a few hours, ideally. Mm-hmm. And it initially was developed in response to needle sticks from infected patients by healthcare providers and has since been extended to non-occupational exposures.
You know, I was a little surprised that this information hadn't come out earlier, or the testing. And I know one of the problems with science is that, in general, we like to make sure we've got good evidence for safety and efficacy before we do it. Had it been considered for a long time that the early use of these antiretroviral treatments could prevent infection from occurring after exposure, or was it somewhat of a surprise that these medications were effective in doing this?
Well, it's been in use for quite a few years. The problem is you can't really do studies on it. So it's a lot of just assumed evidence, but we have not had any proven occupational exposures or infections in many, many years. And then early adopters like San Francisco, it just extended it to sexual exposures. And based on monkey models, it's been shown to be effective. And so,
okay.
I don't know. It has not been. In areas where there's a lot of high risk, then it's more known in the general public.
Okay. All right. Thanks. I have another call. Roger, you're on line one.
Thank you, Doc. I've got a son in California. He's gay. His partner's had full-blown HIV for probably 22 to 25 years. And if it hadn't been for my son being there with him, he probably would have died many times of other infections because of the reduced immune system. And so that's something that people need to be aware of. Once you get the medication against HIV, once you've had it, you have to have somebody you can depend on to help you monitor your health. Otherwise, something else is going to take you out.
Right. We really haven't gone on and discussed. We've talked about HIV infection. We've mentioned AIDS. We haven't really gone on and defined what happens as the immune system gets destroyed, and the consequence of that is multiple and typically unusual infections and even cancers. Thanks for bringing that up.
Okay, thank you, Doc. I appreciate you. I enjoy your program.
All right, well, thanks very much.
Just to elaborate on his point, one of the reasons, you know, just to reemphasize the importance of testing, is that the sooner somebody finds out they're positive and gets on medications, the better their long-term outcome is going to be, the better they're going to be able to preserve their immune system. Once the immune system starts to decline, it's much harder to recover, just like any other disease. The earlier you intervene, you know, and keep somebody healthy, the better off they're going to be. And another point that he didn't bring up, but if his son is negative and his partner is positive, James mentioned earlier PrEP or pre-exposure prophylaxis. So people that are in a situation where they have ongoing exposures, either they have, you know, a lot of partners in a high-risk population like men who have sex with men, or they have a known positive partner, they can take a medication, one pill a day, to help prevent them from getting infected. It's not meant to be, you know, a lifetime medication, but it's meant to help people through usually high-risk periods or periods of exposure. On the other hand, if the HIV-positive person is on their medications and keeping their virus suppressed and then using condoms with their partner, the risk of transmitting the infection is extremely extremely low.
I was going to ask about just the, so there's a couple of different issues there. What's the effectiveness of condoms? But the effectiveness of condoms depends somewhat on the status of the of one of the individuals who might be infected. And so if you're infected, significantly affected, and don't know it, then your risk of transmission is perhaps greater. And condoms, although protective, might be not quite as protective if we looked at large numbers of people. I'm not sure I'm saying that exactly right, but it one of the advantages of treatment is it keeps the number of virus particles down, so the transmission is much less likely, particularly for heterosexual couples where one might be infected. I think that becomes important.
Right, and they've done some big studies, both in heterosexual couples and in men who have sex with men, that have dramatically proven that this is true, that keeping the infected person's virus undetectable decreases the risk to extremely small for transmission. And I just want to bring up condoms. Condoms are very effective if used consistently and correctly, but that is the caveat is they're often not used consistently and not everybody uses them correctly.
That's the same problem with birth control pills,
right,
is they work.
Exactly.
They work, but you got to use them.
Right. Or and, with any medication,
right,
or any,
right,
intervention.
Right. All right. We have an email that asks, what about the discuss the likelihood of transmission of HIV in oral sex or maybe even in dentistry, something like that? What do we know about oral transmission?
So different kinds of sexual activity have very different levels of risk. And we know that anal sex is the most risky activity. Vaginal sex would fall somewhere less than that, but still high risk. And oral sex is actually very low risk for HIV transmission. So low that it's almost even no risk, mm-hmm. but we can't go quite that far. Right. The caveat to that is that oral sex is still risky for other sexually transmitted infections like chlamydia and gonorrhea. So it's not that it is an across-the-board sort of safe activity, but relatively speaking, and for HIV, it is much safer than other activities.
And also, if there's any dental disease or blood present, that increases the risk greatly. But in terms of sexual, as James says, in terms of the spectrum of risk, oral sex would be the least risky in terms of sexual activity.
So another question I had written down here is, what's our evidence that we are having progress in controlling HIV infection? What's the rate of new infections in the U.S. over time? We've heard James tell us that the number of new infections is slightly up, or significantly up, I would say, this year compared to last year, which is always disturbing news. And what are the reasons that we might surmise for that? We talked about the fact that perhaps it's not needle stick exposure that's causing this.
Yeah. Well, the state usually points out that our numbers are so small that you can't really jump to conclusions from year to year. You know, small numbers are, you know, big percentage changes in our state. But we did just have a couple of populations that had some increased numbers. But across the U.S., we really have not seen a decrease in rates, even though, you know, we really do have the tools to decrease them now. And part of that reason is that people are not getting tested and into care, especially the highest risk group in the country in general is African-American men who have sex with men, and a lot of the new infections are concentrated in Southeast U.S. In Alaska, some of the risk has been associated with almost half of it with alcohol and drug abuse because of the behaviors going along with that. And with the men who have sex with men, there's a high association with online sex seeking using sites like Craigslist or Grindr or some various other apps for hooking up with anonymous partners, and also about 30% of the new infections were associated with other sexually transmitted infections that were present.
Let me just take one more time to remind listeners, if they have questions or comments today about HIV or AIDS, that we will be here for another 12 or 13 minutes. And if you'd like to ask questions, you can do so. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433, toll free 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. So what I have down is that one of the most important things we want people to hear today is that we're still finding that there's resistance or ignorance or just plain lack of taking the time to get tested, and that there are good reasons to know if you might be infected. Three of them that I can see pretty quickly are that it can stop the transmission to others. Two, it can treat the stop the progression of your illness, particularly if it's found early. And it can help others find sexual partners that you may have had so that they can be tested and learn their partner, so that it really, all of those would go a long way to decreasing the numbers of cases. Any other comments, any other reasons that jump out at everybody for making sure that we get the message out that they need to get, people need to get tested?
I just want to, I guess, reiterate something that I think Terry said about how our number of new infections in the U.S. has stayed pretty steady for a lot of years now. And we know that most new infections are spread by people who don't know their HIV status. So it's not people who know that they're positive going out and spreading the virus. It's people who have no idea they're carrying the virus.
Right. Okay.
And that's the real importance of testing is that, again, you can keep yourself safe, you can prevent it from being spread to other people, and you can only do that if you know.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Excellent point. Heather, I haven't given you a chance to talk briefly about the AIDS Assistance, Alaska AIDS Assistance Association. You want to give us a little bit of update about your organization and what it's all about before we get off the air today?
Sure. The 4A's has been in Anchorage for 30 years now. This is our 30th anniversary, hard to believe. We have our main office here in Anchorage, and then we also have a satellite office in Juneau. The Juneau office provides the same services that we provide here in Anchorage, and that includes a syringe exchange for that area. There are very few syringe exchanges in the state of Alaska. It's basically our Anchorage office, our Juneau office, and then Interior AIDS Association up in Fairbanks also runs a syringe exchange. So we're lucky to be able to provide those services, but it is a statewide problem and really needs statewide assistance, but it's something we can't help the state with at this point, although we have started conversations with people. The biggest thing of what we do is provide services for those people who are living with HIV and AIDS, providing medical case management, making sure that they have housing, access to good nutrition, are getting the medical care that they need or taking their medications, assisting with transportation so they can get to the medical care that they need and get the services they need. We also do HIV prevention services, education. We go out and do outreach testing, bars and community events, so we're available. And again, it's all free. We're the statewide provider of condoms, so anybody in the state can call the 4A's and we can provide condoms to them for no charge. We'll ship them out. And the other thing that we do is we're a resource for people. So we get calls from people all over the state asking questions about HIV and AIDS and how they can seek services or what's available. So,
and your website is linked to our website. Is there a number that people should write down real quick to call?
They can call our 263-2500 number. No, that's
2050.
Right.
263-2050.
All right. Thanks, James.
Okie doke. David, you're on line one.
Well, hi. I just want to say hi to Heather, for one. And that 4A's does a great job. She should know me. And that I am one of their clients, and I do have HIV, and I take lots of meds. And I think 50% besides doing the meds is your attitude. You know, and you need to have a very positive attitude in that everything's going to work. Because I've had HIV, I've gone into Castleman's, my viral load got all the way up to 350,000, and a CD4 of 10. So, and I'm doing great now.
All right.
Anyways, that's all I have to say.
Yeah, well, thanks for the call, and glad to hear you're doing so well. That's wonderful to hear. All right. Thanks for calling, David. Kim, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for the hard work that you all do. I'm quite impressed. I recognize that the number one person responsible for patient care is the patient themselves. But I was curious, what measures of accountability are in place to ensure that providers are recommending the screening for that target population of 13 to 64 across the state? And I'll take my answer off the call. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, the CDC recommendations are just a recommendation, so it's really voluntary for providers to comply with that. Now, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendation carries a little more weight, but that's really facility dependent on how well they encourage that. I know that, you know, certainly larger organizations have made an attempt to make sure that people that are getting STI screening are also getting HIV screening as part of that. But as we are able to look back when we get new cases, it falls short often.
All right. Terry, here's an email from a very... this is well-educated individual, and she is saying the most unique thing about the 42 infections last year over the 24 from the previous year, that here in Alaska, are those that were diagnosed very early with HIV infection. So of those, 8 apparently had an acute HIV infection and were found. And she goes on to say transmission is greatly increased during acute HIV. So we were finding more infective partners during those investigations. Terry can explain the acute HIV symptoms and diagnosis. And that seems to go against what we've been saying, that it was a relatively asymptomatic infection. Is this writer suggesting something we haven't talked about so far?
Yes. Thanks, Melissa.
From Melissa. Good guess. I hate to give people's names over the...
There has been a change, and that's greatly due to the new testing technology where we're able to actually pick up infection early. And even though in the long run, HIV is asymptomatic for many years. Acutely, when somebody is first infected, after about a week to 10 days, most people will actually have symptoms. They usually look like a really bad flu or mono, frequently fevers, a rash, sore throat, swollen lymph nodes. Any part of the body can be infected, but those are some of the more common symptoms.
Which are not uncommon symptoms. I got to point that out, it sounds like to me.
They're common symptoms of acute HIV infection.
Yeah, but they're also common symptoms of non-HIV infection.
So you have to, you know, take a history.
Not very specific.
Right. Okay. They are not real specific.
All right. But
once
right.
you get a history sometimes...
Yeah. All right.
It really can clue you in.
I'm too worried about people hearing these and say, "Oh my God, I got," which may not be necessarily bad in that people get tested, but
right.
People so often hear, "I got a headache. I must have brain cancer," and that's
right.
one of the least likely reasons.
You know, the clue is that they've had unprotected sex. Usually, is the important part of the history, or they've had sex with a known positive. Things like fever and a rash in an adult, that's a big red flag because that's not usually a common symptom. And the other point is that when somebody's acutely infected in that first month, their viral load, the amount of virus in their blood, goes up into the millions, which translates to very high levels in their genital fluids and their other body fluids. So that does make them extremely infectious. So with the new testing technology that can pick up infection earlier, if somebody does present to medical care and does get screened for HIV, it's much more likely that it will actually be picked up, and so that interventions can be done very quickly, partners can be interviewed very quickly, and we can break the chain at that point. And so that did really reflect in our epidemiology in 2014, because normally about 38% of the new diagnoses already have AIDS. And in 2014, only 12% did, because 8 of the cases were picked up in this acute phase. And that's really something new we're seeing. That extremely early diagnosis. Yeah.
So I guess I'm trying to figure out what this all means. It means that we're still needing people to get tested, but because they are getting symptomatic, we're finding them. It's not because they're coming in saying, I may be at risk. It's because I'm sick and somebody's doing the right thing about asking the right questions and then doing the testing.
And then once one person's identified, our state epidemiology is very good about investigating partners and trying to get to them as quickly as possible and getting them tested and identifying new patients that way as well.
All right. We are coming into the last 2 minutes again. I'd like to end by just asking those of you who are guests to tell us again, what are the most important lessons? What's the most important message today? Heather, let's start with you.
I think what a great deal of this conversation has been about, and that's testing. June 21st through June 27th is National HIV Testing Week. There are events going on. We'll be offering free HIV testing on Saturday, all day Saturday, actually, the day of National HIV Testing Day. We'll be down at the Bus Depot down on 4th Avenue. 5th Avenue?
6th Avenue.
6th Avenue on Saturday, providing free testing. But people can walk into our office anytime and get a test, confidential test, for no charge.
James, you have anything to add?
I would just add that this week and all of the time, the most important thing any individual can do towards HIV prevention is to know their own status.
Okay. Terry?
Yes, I would reiterate all that. Get tested. If your provider doesn't ask your provider why they're not asking you. You should at least have a baseline test. Just because you're married or you're in a monogamous relationship does not mean you have never had any kind of risk. You don't know what kind of risk your partner may have exposed you to. And I just want to put in a quick plug for the website that our prevention people have developed called iKnowMine.com, which has great information, and you can order condoms. It was geared towards rural youth, and there's also a link there to a home STD testing program called I Want the Kit.
I guess it should be pretty self-evident by now, those that are listening and understanding the information today, is that's why all pregnant women have a recommendation to get HIV testing as well. It's unfortunately a captured group where we can look at that pretty quickly. Thanks to each of you for coming today. I want to thank our guests, Terry Brammel, James Terry, and Heather Davis. If you'd like to continue the conversation on HIV/AIDS, you can join KSK on Facebook, and you can find that link at www.alaskapublic.org. If you're thinking about whether or not you should consider monitoring your children's internet use, you ought to listen next week when we talk about internet safety with Lieutenant Nancy Reeder and Officer Angie Fraser of the Anchorage Police Department on Line 1, Your Health Connection. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron was our audio engineer. Monica Gokey is our web editor. And I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.